I'm going to pray more, I promise. You're a good man. You have a good heart and a good mind. You just need some help. I know. I'm not very strong. He had the papers in a folded envelope in his pocket. He pulled them out. Can we at least discuss these? Yes, but only as a favor to you. I figure you've come this far. The least I can do is have our little law chat. Thank you. He handed her the first sheet, a copy of Troy's one-page will. She read it slowly, struggling with parts of the handwriting. When she finished, she asked, "Is this a legal will?" "So far." "But it's so primitive." "Handwritten wills are valid. Sorry, it's the law." She read it again. Nate noticed the shadows falling along the tree line. He had become afraid of the dark, both on land and on water. He was anxious to leave. "Troy didn't care for his other offspring, did he?" she said with amusement. "You wouldn't either. But then I doubt if he was much of a father." "I remember the day my mother told me about him. I was 17. It was late summer. My father had just died of cancer, and life was pretty bleak. Troy had somehow found me and was bugging my mother to visit. She told me the truth about my biological parents, and it meant nothing to me. I didn't care about those people. I'd never known them and had no desire to meet them. I found out later that my birth mother killed herself." "How do you figure that, Nate? Both of my real parents killed themselves. Is there something in my genes?" "No. You're much stronger than they were."
"I welcome death."
"Don't say that. When did you meet Troy?"
"A year went by. He and my mother became phone pals. She became convinced his motives were good, and so one day he came to our house. We had cake and tea, then he left. He sent money for college. He began pressuring me to take a job with one of his companies. He started acting like a father, and I grew to dislike him. Then my mother died, and the world caved in around me. I changed my name and went to med school. I prayed for Troy over the years, the same way I pray for all the lost people I know. I assumed he had forgotten about me."
"Evidently not," Nate said. A black mosquito landed on his thigh, and he slapped with enough violence to crack lumber. If it carried malaria, the insect would spread it no further. A red outline of a handprint appeared on his flesh. He gave her the waiver and the acknowledgement. She read them carefully and said,
"I'm not signing anything. I don't want the money."
"Just keep them, okay? Pray over them."
"Are you making fun of me?"
"No. I just don't know what to do next."
"I can't help you. But I will ask one favor."
"Sure, anything."
"Don't tell anyone where I am. I beg you, Nate, please protect my privacy."
"I promise. But you have to be realistic."
"What do you mean?"
"The story is irresistible. If you take the money, then you're probably the richest woman in the world. If you decline it, then the story is even more compelling."
"Who cares?"
"Bless your heart. You're protected from the media. We have nonstop news now, 24 hours of endless coverage of everything, hours and hours of news programs, news magazines, talking heads, late-breaking stories. It's all junk. No story is too small to be tracked down and sensationalized."
"But how can they find me?"
"That's a good question. We got lucky because Troy had picked up your trail. To our knowledge, though, he told no one."
"Then I'm safe, right? You can't tell. The lawyers in your firm can't tell."
"That's very true.
And you were lost when you arrived here, right?"
"Very lost."
"You have to protect me, Nate. This is my home. These are my people. I don't want to run again."
Humble missionary in jungle says no to $11 billion fortune. What a headline. The vultures would invade the Pantanal with helicopters and amphibious landing craft to get the story. Nate felt sorry for her. "I'll do what I can," he said.
Do I have your word?
Yes, I promise.
The send-off party was led by the chief himself, followed by his wife, then a dozen men, then Jevy, followed by at least 10 more men. They snaked along the trail, headed for the river.
It's time to go, she said.
I guess so. You're sure we'll be safe in the dark?
Yes, the chief is sending his best fishermen. God will protect you. Say your prayers.
I will.
I'll pray for you every day, Nate. You're a good person with a good heart. You're worth saving.
Thank you. You want to get married?
I can't.
Sure you can. I'll take care of the money, you take care of the Indians. We'll get a bigger hut and throw away our clothes.
They both laughed, and they were still smiling when the chief got to them.
Nate stood to say hello or goodbye or something, and for a second his vision was gone. A surge of dizziness rolled from his chest through his head. He caught himself, cleared his vision, and glanced at Rachel to see if she had noticed. She had not. His eyelids began to ache. The joints at his elbows were throbbing. There was a flourish of grunts and ipica, and everyone stepped to the river. Food was placed in Jevy's boat and in the two narrow canoes the guides and Laco would use. Nate thanked Rachel, who in turn thanked the chief, and when all the right farewells were finished, it was time to go. Standing ankle-deep in water, Nate hugged her gently, patting her on the back and saying,
"Thanks."
"Thanks for what?"
"Oh, I don't know. Thanks for creating a fortune in legal fees."
She smiled and said,
"I like you, Nate, but I couldn't care less about the money and the lawyers."
"I like you, too.
Please don't come back."
"Don't worry." Everyone was waiting. The fishermen were already on the river. Jevy had his paddle, anxious to shove off. Nate took a step into the boat and said,
"We could honeymoon in Corumbá."
"Goodbye, Nate. Just tell your people you never found me."
"I will."
"So long."
He pushed away and swung himself into the boat, where he sat down hard, his head spinning again. As they drifted away, he waved at Rachel and the Indians, but the figures were blurred together. Pushed by the current, the canoes glided over the water, the Indians paddling in perfect tandem. They wasted no effort and no time. They were in a hurry. The motor started on the third pull, and they soon caught the canoes. When Jevy throttled down, the motor sputtered but did not quit. At the first turn in the river, Nate glanced over his shoulder. Rachel and the Indians hadn't moved. He was sweating. With clouds shielding the sun and with a nice breeze in his face, Nate realized that he was sweating. His arms and legs were wet. He rubbed his neck and forehead and looked at the dampness on his fingers. Instead of praying, as he had promised, he mumbled, "Oh, shit. I'm sick." The fever was low, but coming fast. The breeze chilled him. He huddled on his seat and looked for something else to wear. Jevy noticed him and after a few minutes said, "Nate, are you okay?" He shook his head no, and pain shot from his eyes to his spine. He wiped drainage from his nose. After two bends in the river, the trees grew thin and the ground was lower. The river widened, then spilled into a flooded lake with three decaying trees in the center of it. Nate knew they had not passed the trees on the way in. They were taking a different route out. Without the current, the canoe slowed a little, but still cut through the water with amazing quickness. The guides did not study the lake. They knew exactly where they were going.
"Jevy, I think I have malaria," Nate said. His voice was hoarse, his throat already sore.
"How do you know?" Jevy lowered the throttle for a second.
"Rachel warned me. She saw it in the other village yesterday. That's why we left when we did."
"Do you have a fever?"
"Yes, and I'm having trouble seeing things."
Chevy stopped the boat and yelled at the Indians, who were almost out of sight. He moved empty gas tanks and the remnants of their supplies, then quickly unrolled the tent. "You will get chills," he said as he worked. The boat rocked back and forth as he moved around. "Have you had malaria?" "No, but most of my friends have died from it."
"What?"
"Bad joke. It doesn't kill many, but you will be very sick." Moving gently, keeping his head as still as possible, Nate crawled behind his seat and lay in the center of the boat. A bedroll was his pillow. Chevy spread the lightweight tent over him and anchored it with two empty gas tanks. The Indians were beside them, curious about what was happening. Laco inquired in Portuguese. Nate heard the word malaria spoken by Chevy, and it caused mumblings in Ipica. Then they were off. The boat seemed faster. Maybe it was because Nate was lying on the bottom of it, feeling it slice through the water. An occasional branch or limb that Chevy didn't see jolted Nate, but he didn't care. His head ached and throbbed like no hangover he'd ever experienced. His muscles and joints hurt too much to move. And he was growing colder. The chills were starting. There was a low rumble in the distance. Nate thought it might be thunder. "Wonderful," he thought. "That's precisely what we need now." The rain stayed away. The river turned once to the west, and Chevy saw the orange and yellow remnants of a sunset. Then it turned back to the east, to the approaching darkness across the Pantanal. Twice the canoe slowed as the Ipecas conferred about which fork to take. Chevy kept their boat 100 feet or so behind, but as darkness settled in, he followed closer. He couldn't see Nate buried under the tent, but he knew his friend was suffering. Chevy actually once knew a man who died from malaria. 2 hours into the journey, the guides led them through a bewildering series of narrow streams and quiet lagoons. And when they emerged into a broader river, the canoe slowed for a moment. The Indians needed a rest. Laco called to Chevy and explained that they were now safe, that they had just gone through the difficult part, and the rest should be easy. The Checo was about 2 hours away, and it led straight to the Paraguay. "Can we make it alone?" Chevy asked. "No," came the reply. There were still forks to deal with, plus the Indians knew a spot on the Checo that would not be flooded. There they would sleep. "How is the American?" Laco asked. "Not well," Chevy replied. The American heard their voices, and he knew the boat was not moving. The fever burned him from head to toe. His flesh and clothes were soaked, and the aluminum under him was wet as well. His eyes were swollen shut, his mouth so dry it hurt to open it. He heard Chevy asking him something in English, but he could not answer. Consciousness came and went. In the darkness, the canoes moved more slowly. Chevy trailed closer, at times using his flashlight to help the guide study the forks and tributaries. At half throttle, his unsteady outboard settled into a constant whine. They stopped just once to eat a loaf of bread and drink juice and to relieve themselves. They latched the three craft together and floated for 10 minutes. Laco was concerned about the American. "What shall I tell the missionary about him?" he asked Chevy. "Tell her he has malaria." Lightning in the distance ended their brief dinner and rest. The Indians set off again, paddling as hard as ever. They had not seen solid ground in hours. There was no place to land and ride out a storm. The motor finally quit. Chevy switched to his last full tank and started it again. At half throttle, he had enough fuel for about 6 hours, long enough to find the Paraguay. There would be traffic there, and houses, and at some point, the Santa Laura. He knew the exact spot where the Checo emptied into the Paraguay. Going downriver, they should find Welly by dawn. The lightning followed, but did not catch them. Each flash made the guides work harder. But they began to tire. At one point, Laco grabbed a side of the John boat, another Ipica held the other, Chevy held the flashlight above his head, and they plowed forward like a barge. The trees and brush grew thicker and the river widened. There was solid ground on both sides. The Indians were chattering more, and when they entered the Shekko, the paddling stopped. They were exhausted and ready to stop. It's 3 hours past their bedtime, Chevy thought. They found their spot and landed. Lako explained that he had been the missionary's assistant for many years. He'd seen lots of malaria. He'd even had it himself 3 times. He eased the tent off Nate's head and chest and touched his forehead. A very high fever, he told Chevy, who was holding the flashlight, standing in mud and anxious to get back in the boat. There's nothing you can do, he said as he completed his diagnosis. The fever will go away, then there will be another attack in 48 hours. He was disturbed by the swollen eyes, something he'd never seen before with malaria. The oldest guide began talking to Lako and pointing to the dark river. The translation to Chevy was to keep it in the center, ignore the small divides, especially the ones to the left, and in 2 hours he should find the Paraguay. Chevy thanked them profusely and took off. The fever didn't die. An hour later, Chevy checked Nate and his face was still burning. He was curled into a fetal position, semi-conscious and mumbling incoherently. Chevy forced water into his mouth, then poured the rest over his face. The Shekko was wide and easy to navigate. They passed a house, the first they'd seen in a month, it seemed. Like a lighthouse beckoning a wayward ship, the moon broke through the clouds and lit the waters in front of them. Can you hear me, Nate? Chevy said, not loud enough to be heard. Our luck is changing. He followed the moon to the Paraguay. Chapter 32. The boat was a chawana, a floating shoebox 30 feet long, 8 feet wide, flat-bottomed, and used to haul cargo through the Pantanal. Chevy had captained dozens of them. He saw the light coming around a bend, and when he heard the knock of the diesel, he knew precisely what kind of boat it was. And he knew the captain, who was sleeping on his bunk when the deckhand stopped the chawana. It was almost 3 a.m. Chevy tied his John boat to the bow and hopped on board. They fed him 2 bananas while he gave them a quick summary of what he was doing. The deckhand brought sweet coffee. They were headed north to Puerto Indio, to the army base there, to trade with the soldiers. They could spare 5 gallons of gas. Chevy promised to pay them back in Corumbá. No problem. Everybody helps on the river. More coffee and some sugared wafers. Then he asked about the Santa Laura and Welly. It's at the mouth of the Cabisha, Chevy told them. Docked where the old pier used to be, he said. They shook their heads. He wasn't there, the captain said. The deckhand agreed. They knew the Santa Laura, and they had not seen it. It would have been impossible to miss. It has to be there, Chevy said. No. We passed the Cabisha at noon yesterday. There was no sign of the Santa Laura. Perhaps Welly had taken it a few miles into the Cabisha to look for them. He had to be worried sick. Chevy would forgive him for moving the Santa Laura, but not before a tongue-lashing. The boat would be there, he was certain. He sipped more coffee and told them about Nate and the malaria. There were fresh rumors in Corumbá about waves of the disease sweeping through the Pantanal. Chevy had heard these all of his life. They filled a tank from a barrel on board the Shawana. As a general rule, river traffic during the rainy season was 3 times faster downstream than up. A John boat with a good motor should reach the Cabisha in 4 hours, the trading post in 10, Corumbá in 18. The Santa Laura, if and when they found it, would take longer, but at least they would have hammocks and food. Chevy's plan was to stop and rest briefly on the Santa Laura. He wanted to get Nate into a bed, and he would use the sat phone to call Corumbá and talk to Valdir. Valdir, in turn, could find a good doctor who would know what to do when they reached home. The captain gave him another box of wafers and a paper cup of coffee. Chevy promised to find them in Corumbá next week. He thanked them and unhitched his boat. Nate was alive, but motionless. The fever had not broken. The coffee quickened Chevy's pulse and kept him awake. He played with the throttle, raising it until the engine began to sputter, then backing down before it died. As the darkness faded, a heavy mist fell upon the river. He arrived at the mouth of the Cabixá an hour after dawn. The Santa Laura was not there. Xavi docked at the old pier and went to find the owner of the only nearby house. He was in his stable, milking a cow. He remembered Xavi and told the story of the storm that took away the boat. The worst storm ever. It happened in the middle of the night, and he didn't see much. The wind was so fierce that he, his wife, and his child hid under a bed. "Where did it sink?" Xavi asked.
"I don't know."
"What about the boy?"
"Welly, I don't know."
"Haven't you talked to anyone else? Has anyone seen the boy?" No one. He had not spoken with anyone off the river since Welly disappeared in the storm. He was very sad about everything, and for good measure offered the opinion that Welly was probably dead. Nate was not. The fever dipped significantly, and when he awoke he was cold and thirsty. He opened his eyes with his fingers and saw only the water around him, the brush on the bank, and the farmhouse.
"Xavi,"
he said, his throat raw, his voice weak. He sat up and worked on his eyes for a few minutes. Nothing focused. Xavi did not answer. Every part of his body ached, muscles, joints, the blood pumping through his brain. There was a hot rash on his neck and chest, and he scratched it until the skin broke. He was sickened by his own odor. The farmer and his wife followed Xavi back to the boat. They didn't have a drop of gasoline, and this irritated their visitor.
"How are you, Nate?"
he asked, stepping into the boat.
"I'm dying,"
he exhaled the words. Xavi felt his forehead, then gently touched the rash.
"Your fever is down." "Where are we?"
"We're at the Cabixá.
Welly is not here. The boat sank in a storm."
"Our luck continues,"
Nate said, then grimaced as pain shot through his head.
"Where is Welly?"
"I don't know. Can you make it to Corumbá?"
"I'd rather just go ahead and die."
"Lie down, Nate."
They left the bank with the farmer and his wife standing ankle deep in mud, waving but getting ignored. Nate sat for a while. The wind felt good against his face. Before long, though, he was cold again. A chill shuddered through his chest, and he lowered himself gently under the tent. He tried to pray for Welly, but thoughts lasted only for seconds. He simply couldn't believe he'd caught malaria. Hark planned the brunch in great detail. It was in a private dining room of the Hay Adams Hotel. There were oysters and eggs, caviar and salmon, champagne and mimosas. By 11 they were all there, dressed casually and laying into the mimosas. He had assured them the meeting was of the utmost importance. It had to be kept confidential. He'd found the one witness who could win the case for them. Only the lawyers for the Phelan children were invited. The Phelan wives had not yet contested the will, and there seemed little enthusiasm on their part for getting involved. Their legal position was very weak. Judge Wycliffe had hinted off the record to one of their lawyers that he would not look favorably upon frivolous suits by the ex-wives. Frivolous or not, the six children had wasted no time contesting the will. All six had rushed into the fray, all with the same basic claim, that Troy Phelan lacked mental capacity when he signed his last testament. A maximum of two lawyers per heir were allowed at the meeting, and preferably one if possible. Hark was alone, representing Rex. Wally Bright was alone, representing Libigale. Yancey was the only lawyer Ramble knew. Grit was there for Mary Ross. Madam Langhorne, the former professor of law, was there for Gina and Cody. Troy Jr. had hired and fired three firms since his father's death. His latest lawyers were from a firm of 400. Their names were Hemba and Hamilton, and they introduced themselves to the loose-knit confederation. Hart closed the door and addressed the group. He gave a short biography of Malcolm Sneed, a man he'd been meeting with almost daily. He was with Mr. Phelan for 30 years, he said gravely. Maybe he helped him write his last will. Maybe he is prepared to say the old man was completely nuts at the time. The lawyers were surprised by the news. Hark watched their happy faces for a moment, then said, "Or, maybe he is prepared to say he knew nothing of the handwritten will, and that Mr. Phelan was perfectly rational and lucid the day he died."
"How much does he want?" asked Wally Bright, cutting to the chase.
$5 million. 10% now, the rest upon settlement. Sneed's fee did not faze the lawyers. There was so much at stake. In fact, his greed seemed rather modest. "Our clients, of course, do not have the money," Hark said. "So if we want to purchase his testimony, then it's up to us. For about $85,000 per heir, we can sign a contract with Mr. Sneed. I'm convinced he will deliver testimony that will either win the case or force a settlement." The range of wealth in the room was broad. Wally Bright's office account was overdrawn. He owed back taxes. At the other end of the spectrum, the firm where Hemba and Hamilton worked had partners earning more than $1 million a year. "Are you suggesting we pay a lying witness?" Hamilton asked.
"We don't know if he's lying," Hark responded.
He could anticipate every question. "No one knows. He was alone with Mr. Phelan. There are no witnesses. The truth will be whatever Mr. Sneed wants it to be."
"This sounds shady," Hamba added.
"You have a better idea,"
Grit growled. He was into his fourth mimosa. Hemba and Hamilton were big firm lawyers, unaccustomed to the dirt and grime from the streets. Not that they or their ilk were beyond corruption, but their clients were rich corporations that used lobbyists for legal bribery to land fat government contracts and hid money in Swiss accounts for foreign despots, all with the help of their trusty lawyers. But because they were big firm lawyers, they quite naturally looked down upon the type of unethical behavior being suggested by Hark and condoned by Grit and Bright and the other ham and eggers.
"I'm not sure our client will agree to this," Hamilton said.
"Your client will jump at it," Hark said. It was almost humorous to drape ethics over T.J. Phelan.
"We know him better than you. The question is whether you're willing to do it."
"Are you suggesting we, the lawyers, front the initial $500,000? Hemba asked, his tone one of contempt.
"Exactly," Hark said.
"Then our firm would never go along with such a scheme."
"Then your firm is about to be replaced," Grit chimed in. "Keep in mind, you're the fourth bunch in a month."
In fact, Troy Jr. had already threatened to fire them. They grew quiet and listened. Hark had the floor.
"To avoid the embarrassment of asking each of us to cough up the cash, I have found a bank willing to loan $500,000 for a year. All we need is 6 signatures on the loan. I've already signed."
"I'll sign the damned thing,"
Bright said in a burst of machismo. He was fearless because he had nothing to lose.
"Let me get this straight," Yancey said. "We pay Sneed the money first, then he talks, right?"
"Right."
"Shouldn't we hear his version first?"
"His version needs some work. That's the beauty of the deal. Once we pay him, he's ours. We get to shape his testimony, to structure it to suit ourselves. Keep in mind there are no other witnesses, maybe with the exception of a secretary."
"How much does she cost?" asked Grit.
"She's free. She's included in Sneed's package." How many times in a career would you get the chance to rake off a percentage of the country's 10th largest fortune? The lawyers did the math. A little risk here, a gold mine later. Madame Langhorne surprised them by saying, "I'll recommend to my firm that we take the deal. But this has to be a graveyard secret."
"Graveyard," repeated Yancey. "We could all be disbarred, probably indicted. Suborning perjury is a felony."
"You're missing the point," Grit said. "There can be no perjury. The truth is defined by Sneed and Sneed alone.
If he says he helped write the will, and at the time the old man was nuts, then who in the world can dispute it? It's a brilliant deal. I'll sign.
That makes four of us, Hark said.
I'll sign, Yancey said.
Hemba and Hamilton were squirming.
We'll have to discuss it with our firm, Hamilton said.
Do we have to remind you boys that all of this is confidential? Bright said.
It was comical, the street fighter from night school chiding the law review editors on ethics.
No, Hemba said. You don't have to remind us.
Hark would call Rex, tell him about the deal, and Rex would then call his brother TJ and inform him that his new lawyers were screwing up the deal. Hemba and Hamilton would be history within 48 hours.
Move quickly, Hark warned them. Mr. Sneed claims to be broke and is perfectly willing to cut a deal with the other side.
Speaking of which, Langhorne said, do we know any more about who's on the other side? We're all contesting the will. Someone has to be its proponent. Where is Rachel Lane?
Evidently she's hiding, Hark said. Josh has assured me that they know where she is, that they are in contact with her, and that she will hire lawyers to protect her interests.
For $11 billion, I would hope so, added Grit.
They pondered the $11 billion for a moment, each dividing it by various magnitudes of the number 6, then applying their own personal percentages. $5 million for Sneed seemed such a reasonable sum. Jevy and Nate limped to the trading post early in the afternoon. The outboard was missing badly and low on gas. Fernando, the owner of the store, was in a hammock on the porch, trying to avoid the scorching sun. He was an old man, a rugged veteran of the river who'd known Jevy's father. Both men helped Nate from the boat. He was burning with fever again. His legs were numb and weak, and the three of them inched carefully along the narrow pier and up the steps to the porch. When they folded him into the hammock, Jevy delivered a quick review of the past week. Fernando missed nothing on the river.
"The Santa Laura sank," he said. "There was a big storm."
"Have you seen Welly?" Jevy asked.
"Yes, he was pulled from the river by a cattle boat. They stopped here. He told me the story. I'm sure he's in Corumbá."
Jevy was relieved to hear that Welly was alive. The loss of the boat, however, was tragic news. The Santa Laura was one of the finer boats in the Pantanal. It went down under his watch. Fernando was studying Nate as they talked. Nate could barely hear their words. He certainly couldn't understand them, not that he cared.
"This is not malaria," Fernando said, touching the rash on Nate's neck.
Jevy moved to the hammock and looked at his friend. His hair was matted and wet, his eyes still swollen shut.
"What is it?" he asked.
"Malaria doesn't produce a rash like this. Dengue does."
"Dengue fever?"
"Yes, it's similar to malaria. Fever and chills, sore muscles and joints, spread by mosquitoes. But the rash means it's dengue."
"My father had it once. He was a very sick man."
"You need to get him to Corumbá as quickly as possible."
"Can I borrow your motor?"
Fernando's boat was docked under the rickety building. His outboard wasn't as rusty as Jevy's, and it had 5 more horsepower. They scurried around, swapping motors and filling tanks, and after an hour in the hammock, comatose, poor Nate was shuffled back down the pier and laid into the boat under the tent. He was too sick to realize what was happening. It was almost 2:30. Corumbá was 9 to 10 hours away. Jevy left Valdir's phone number with Fernando. On rare occasions, a boat on the Paraguay would have a radio. If Fernando happened to encounter one, Jevy wanted him to contact Valdir with the news. He sped away at full throttle, quite proud to once again have a boat that sliced through the water with speed. The wake boiled behind him. Dengue fever could be fatal. His father had been deathly ill for a week, with blinding headaches and fevers. His eyes hurt so badly that his mother kept him in a dark room for days.
He was a tough river man, accustomed to injuries and pain, and when Jevy heard him moaning like a child, he knew his father was dying. The doctor visited every other day, and finally the fever broke. He could see Nate's feet from under the tent, nothing else. Surely he wouldn't die. Chapter 33. He woke once, but couldn't see. He woke again, and it was dark. He tried to say something to Jevy about water, just a small drink, and maybe a bite of bread, but his voice was gone. Speaking required effort and movement, especially when trying to yell over the howl of the engine. His joints pulled him tightly into a knot. He was welded to the aluminum shell of the boat. Rachel lay beside him under the smelly tent, her knees also pulled close and just touching his, same as when they sat together on the ground in front of her hut and later on the bench under the tree by the river. A cautious little contact from a woman starved for the innocent feeling of flesh. She had lived among the Ipecas for 11 years, and their nakedness kept a distance between themselves and any civilized person. A simple hug was complicated. Where do you hold? Where do you pat? How long do you squeeze? Surely she'd never touched any of the males. He wanted to kiss her, if only on the cheek, because she had obviously gone years without such affection. When was your last kiss, Rachel? He wanted to ask her. You've been in love. How physical was it? But he kept his questions to himself, and instead they talked about people they didn't know. She'd had a piano teacher whose breath was so bad the ivory keys turned yellow. He had a lacrosse coach who was paralyzed from the waist down because he cracked his spine in a lacrosse game. A girl in her church got pregnant, and her father condemned her from the pulpit. She killed herself a week later. He'd lost a brother to leukemia. He rubbed her knees, and she seemed to like it. But he would go no further. It wouldn't pay to get fresh with a missionary. She was there to keep him from dying. She'd fought malaria twice herself. The fevers rise and fall. The chills hit like ice in the belly, then fade away. The nausea comes in waves. Then there is nothing for hours. She patted his arm and promised he was not going to die. She tells everybody this, he thought. Death would be welcome. The touching stopped. He opened his eyes and reached for Rachel, but she was gone. Jevy heard the delirium twice. Each time he stopped the boat and pulled the tent off Nate. He forced water into his mouth and poured it gently through his sweating hair. We're almost there, he said over and over. Almost there. The first lights of Corumbá brought tears to his eyes. He had seen them many times when returning from excursions into the northern Pantanal, but they had never been so welcome. They flickered on the hill in the distance. He counted them until they blurred together. It was almost 11 p.m. when he jumped into the shallow water and pulled his rig onto the broken concrete. The boat dock was deserted. He ran up the hill to a payphone. Valdir was watching television in his pajamas, smoking his last cigarette of the night and ignoring his cranky wife when the phone rang. He answered it without getting up, then jumped to his feet. "What is it?" she asked as he ran to the bedroom. "Jevy's back," he answered over his shoulder. "Who's Jevy?" Passing by her on the way out, he said, "I'm going to the river." She couldn't have cared less. Driving across the city, he called a doctor friend who had just gone to bed and cajoled him into meeting them at the hospital. Jevy was pacing along the dock. The American was sitting on a rock, his head resting on his knees. Without a word, they gently shuffled him into the back seat and took off, gravel flying behind them. Valdir had so many questions he didn't know where to start. The harsh words could wait. "When did he get sick?" he asked in Portuguese. Chevy sat next to him, rubbing his eyes, trying to stay awake. His last sleep had been with the Indians.
"I don't know," he said. "The days all run together. It's dengue fever. The rash comes on the fourth or fifth day, and I think he's had it for 2 days. I don't know."
They were racing through downtown, ignoring lights and signs. The sidewalk cafes were closing. There was little traffic.
"Did you find the woman?"
"We did."
"Where?"
"She's close to the mountains. I think she's in Bolivia, a day south of Puerto Indio."
"Was she on the map?"
"No."
"Then how did you find her?"
No Brazilian could ever admit to being lost, especially a seasoned guide like Chevy. It would hurt his self-esteem and perhaps his business.
"We were in a flooded region where maps mean nothing. I found a fisherman who helped us. How's Welly?"
"Welly's fine. The boat's gone."
Valdir was much more concerned about the boat than about its deckhand.
"I've never seen such storms. We've been hit with 3 of them."
"What did the woman say?"
"I don't know. I didn't really talk to her."
"Was she surprised to see you?"
"She didn't seem to be. She was pretty cool. I think she liked our friend back there."
"How did their meeting go?"
"Ask him."
Nate was curled tightly in the back seat, hearing nothing. And Chevy was supposed to know nothing, so Valdir didn't press. The lawyers could talk later, as soon as Nate was able. A wheelchair was waiting at the curb when they arrived at the hospital. They poured Nate into it and followed the orderly along the sidewalk. The air was warm and sticky, still very hot. On the front steps, a dozen maids and assistants in white uniforms smoked cigarettes and chatted quietly. The hospital had no air conditioning. The doctor friend was brusque and all business. The paperwork would be done in the morning. They pushed Nate through the empty lobby, along a series of hallways, and into a small exam room where a sleepy nurse took him. With Chevy and Valdir watching in a corner, the doctor and nurse stripped the patient bare. The nurse washed him with alcohol and white cloths. The doctor studied the rash, which began at his chin and stopped at his waist. He was covered with mosquito bites, many of which he'd scratched into little red sores. They checked his temperature, blood pressure, heart rate.
"Looks like dengue fever,"
the doctor said after 10 minutes. He then rattled off a list of details for the nurse, who hardly listened because she'd done it before. She began washing Nate's hair. Nate mumbled something, but it had nothing to do with anyone present. His eyes were still swollen shut. He hadn't shaved in a week. He would have been at home in a gutter outside a bar.
"The fever is high," the doctor said. "He is delirious. We'll start an IV with antibiotics and painkillers, lots of water, maybe a little food later."
The nurse placed a heavy gauze bandage over Nate's eyes, then strapped it down with tape from ear to ear. She found a vein and started the IV. She pulled a yellow gown from a drawer and dressed him. The doctor checked his temperature again.
"It should begin falling soon," he told the nurse. "If not, call me at home."
He glanced at his watch.
"Thanks," Valdir said.
"I'll see him early in the morning," the doctor said, and left them there.
Chevy lived on the edge of town, where the houses were small, the streets unpaved. He fell asleep twice as Valdir drove him home. Mrs. Stafford was shopping for antiques in London. The phone rang a dozen times before Josh grabbed it. The digital gave the time as 2:20 a.m.
"This is Valdir," the voice announced.
"Oh, yes, Valdir."
Josh rubbed his hair and blinked his eyes.
"This better be good. Your boy's back."
"Thank God."
"He's very sick, though."
"What? What's the matter with him?"
"He has dengue fever, similar to malaria. Mosquitoes carry it. It is not uncommon here."
"I thought he had shots for everything."
Josh was on his feet, bent at the waist, pulling his hair now.
"There is no shot for dengue."
"He's not going to die, is he?"
"Oh, no. He's in the hospital. I have a good friend who is a doctor, and he's taking care of him. He says your boy will be fine."
When can I talk to him?
Maybe tomorrow. He has a high fever and he's unconscious.
Did he find the woman?
Yes.
Atta boy, thought Josh. He exhaled in relief and sat on the bed. So she's really out there. Give me his room number.
Well, they don't have phones in the rooms.
It's a private room, isn't it? Come on, Val, dear, money is no problem here. Tell me he's being taken care of.
He is in good hands, but the hospital is a little different from yours.
Should I come down there?
If you wish. It's not necessary. You can't change the hospital. He has a good doctor.
How long will he be there?
A few days. We should know more in the morning.
Call me early, Val, dear. I mean it. I have to talk to him as soon as possible.
Yes, I will call early.
Josh went to the kitchen for ice water. Then he paced around his den. At 3, he gave up, made a pot of strong coffee, and went to his office in the basement. Because he was a rich American, they cut no corners. Nate got pumped into his veins the best drugs available from the pharmacy. The fever dipped a little, the sweating stopped. The pain vanished, washed away by a tide of the finest American-made chemicals. He was snoring heavily as the nurse and an orderly rolled him to his room 2 hours after his arrival. He would share the room for the night with 5 others. Mercifully, he was blindfolded and comatose. He couldn't see the open sores, the uncontrolled shaking of the old man next to him, the lifeless, shriveled creature across the room. He couldn't smell the waste. Chapter 34. Though he held no assets in his own name, and had been on the financial ropes for most of his adult life, Rex Phelan had a talent for numbers. It was one of the very few things he inherited from his father. He was the only Phelan heir with both the aptitude and the stamina to read all 6 of the petitions contesting Troy's will. When he finished, he realized that 6 law firms were basically duplicating each other's work. In fact, some of the legalese sounded as if it had been borrowed from the last petition, or the next one. 6 firms fighting the same fight, and each wanting an exorbitant piece of the pie. It was time for a little familial harmony. He decided to begin with his brother TJ, who was the easiest target because his lawyers were clinging to their ethics. The two brothers agreed to meet in secret. Their wives hated each other, and discord could be avoided if the women simply didn't know. Rex told Troy Jr. on the phone that it was time to bury the hatchet. Economics demanded it. They met for breakfast in a suburban pancake house, and after a few minutes of waffles and football talk, the edge was off. Rex got down to business by telling the Sneed story. "This is enormous," he gushed. "It could literally make or break our case." He layered the story, slowly building to the promissory note the lawyers wanted to sign, all lawyers except for Troy Jr.'s. "Your attorneys are screwing up the deal," he said grimly, eyes darting around as if spies were grazing at the egg and bacon bar. "Son of a bitch wants $5 million?" Troy Jr. said, still in disbelief over Sneed. "It's a bargain. Look, he was the only person with Dad when he wrote the will. He's willing to say whatever it takes to strike it down. He only wants $500,000 now. We can screw him out of the rest of it later." This appealed to Troy Jr., and changing law firms was certainly nothing new to him. If he'd been candid, he would have admitted that Hemba and Hamilton's firm was intimidating. 400 lawyers, marble foyers, art on the wall. Somebody was paying for their good taste. Rex switched gears. "Have you read the 6 petitions?" he asked. Troy Jr. chomped a strawberry and shook his head no. He hadn't even read the one filed on his behalf. Hemba and Hamilton had discussed it with him, and he'd signed it, but it was thick, and Biff had been waiting in the car. Well, I've read them, slowly and carefully, and they're all the same. We have 6 law firms doing the same work, all attacking the same will. It's absurd.
I've been thinking about that, Troy Jr. added helpfully.
And all 6 expect to get rich when we settle. How much are your boys getting?
How much is Hart Getty's getting?
25%.
Mine wanted 30. We agreed on 20.
There was a quick flash of pride because Troy Jr. had out-negotiated Rex. Let's play with the numbers, Rex continued. Hypothetically, let's say we hire Sneed. He says all the right things, we got our shrinks, the mess gets stirred up, and the estate wants to settle. Let's say each heir gets, I don't know, say 20 million. That's 40 at this table. 5 goes to Hark, 4 goes to your boys, that's 9, so we get 31.
I'll take it.
Me too. But if we take your boys out of the picture and join up, then Hark will cut his fee. We don't need all these lawyers, TJ. They're just riding each other's backs and waiting to pounce on our money.
I hate Hart Getty's.
Fine, let me deal with him. I'm not asking you to be friends.
Why don't we fire Hark and stick with my guys?
Because Hark found Sneed. Because Hark found the bank that'll loan the money to buy Sneed. Because Hark is willing to sign the papers and your boys are too ethical. This is a nasty business, TJ. Hark understands it.
He strikes me as being a crooked bastard.
Yes, and he's our crook. If we join forces, his take goes from 25 to 20. If we can bring in Mary Ross, then he'll cut it to 17.5. Libigale down to 15.
We'll never get Libigale.
There's always a chance. If the 3 of us are on board, she might listen.
What about that thug she's married to?
Troy Jr. actually asked the question with complete sincerity. He was talking to his brother, who was married to a stripper. We'll take him one at a time. Let's cut our deal, then we go see Mary Ross. Her lawyer is that grit guy, and he doesn't strike me as being too sharp.
There's no sense fighting, Troy Jr. said sadly.
It'll cost us a bloody fortune. It's time for a truce.
Mom will be proud.
The high ground on the Shekko had been used by the Indians for decades. It was a camp for fishermen who sometimes stayed the night, and it was a stopping place for river traffic. Rachel and Laco, and another tribesman named Ten, huddled under a lean-to with a straw roof and waited for the storm to pass. The roof leaked, and the wind blew the rain sideways at their faces. The canoe was at their feet, dragged from the Shekko after battling the storm for a horrifying hour. Rachel's clothing was soaked, but at least the rainwater was warm. The Indians wore no clothing except for a string around their waists and a leather covering over their privates. She once had a wooden boat with an old motor. It had belonged to the Coopers, her predecessors. When there was gasoline, she used it on the rivers between the 4 Ipica settlements. And it would take her to Corumbá in 2 very long days, 4 on the return. The motor had finally quit, and there was no money for a new one. Each year, when she submitted her modest budget to World Tribes, she prayerfully requested a new outboard, or at least a good used one. She had found one in Corumbá for $300, but budgets were tight around the world. Her allotments went for medical supplies and Bible literature. Keep praying, she was told. Maybe next year. She accepted this without question. If the Lord meant for her to have a new outboard, then she would have one. The questions of if and when were left for him. They were not for her to worry about. Without a boat, she traveled between the villages on foot, almost always with Laco limping at her side. And once each August, she convinced the chief to loan her a canoe and a guide for the journey to the Paraguay. There she would wait for a cattle boat or a chawana headed south. 2 years before, she had waited for 3 days, sleeping in the stable of a small fazenda on the river. In 3 days, she went from a stranger to a friend to a missionary, as the farmer and his wife became Christians under her teachings and prayer. She would stay with them tomorrow and wait for a boat
to Corumbá. The wind howled through the lean-to. She held Lako's hand and they prayed, not for their safety, but for the health of their friend, Nate. Breakfast was served to Mr. Stafford at his desk, cereal and fruit. He refused to leave the office, and when he declared that he would in fact hole up there all day, both of his secretaries scurried to rearrange no less than 6 meetings. A bagel at 10 at the desk. He called Valdir and was told that he was out of the office, in a meeting somewhere across town. Valdir had a cell phone. Why hadn't he called? An associate delivered a 2-page summary of dengue taken from the internet. The associate said he was needed in court and asked if Mr. Stafford had any more medical work for him. Mr. Stafford did not see the humor. Josh read the summary with his bagel. It was in all caps, double-spaced with 1-inch margins, about a page and a half long. A Stafford memo. Dengue fever is a viral infection common throughout the tropical regions of the world. It is spread by a mosquito known as the Aedes, which prefers to bite during the day. The first sign is tiredness, followed quickly by a severe headache behind the eyes, then a mild fever that soon turns into an intense one, with sweating and nausea and vomiting. As the fever rises, the muscles in the calves and back begin to ache. The fever is also known as breakbone fever, because of the brutal muscle and joint pains. A rash appears after all other symptoms are present. The fever may break for a day or so, but it usually returns with increased intensity. After about a week, the infection wanes and the danger is gone. There is no cure and no vaccine. It takes a month of rest and liquids to return to normal. And that's a mild case. Dengue can progress into dengue hemorrhagic fever or dengue shock syndrome, both of which are sometimes fatal, especially in children. Josh was prepared to send Mr. Phelan's jet to Corumbá to collect Nate. On board would be a doctor and a nurse and anything else that might be needed. "It's Mr. Valdir," a secretary said through the intercom. No other calls were being taken. He was at the hospital.
"I've just checked on Mr. O'Reilly," he said slowly, precisely. "He is okay, but he is not very conscious."
"Can he talk?" Josh asked.
"No, not now. They're giving him drugs for his pain."
"Does he have a good doctor?"
"The best, a friend of mine. The doctor's with him now."
"Ask him when Mr. O'Reilly will be able to fly home. I will send a private jet and a doctor to Corumbá."
There was a conversation in the background.
"Not soon," Valdir reported. "He will need rest when he leaves the hospital."
"When will he leave the hospital?"
Another conversation.
"He can't say right now."
Josh shook his head and flung the remnants of his bagel into the wastebasket.
"Did you say anything to Mr. O'Reilly?" he growled at Valdir.
"No, I think he's asleep."
"Listen, Mr. Valdir, it is very important that I talk to him as soon as possible, okay?"
"I understand this, but you must be patient."
"I'm not a patient man."
"I understand this, but you must try."
"Call me this afternoon."
Josh slammed the phone down and began pacing. It had been an unwise decision to send Nate, fragile and unstable as he was, into the dangers of the tropics. Convenience had been the reason. Send him away for a couple of weeks more, keep him busy elsewhere while the firm sorts out his mess. There were 4 lesser partners in his firm besides Nate, 4 Josh had handpicked and hired and mentored and listened to on some matters of management. Tip was one, and he was the sole voice of support for Nate. The other 3 wanted him gone. Nate's secretary had been reassigned. A rising associate had been borrowing his office lately and was said to have found a home. If dengue fever didn't get poor Nate, the IRS was waiting. The IV bag emptied silently around the middle of the day, though no one bothered to check it. Several hours later, Nate woke up. His head was light and at peace, with no fever. He was stiff, but not sweating. He felt the heavy gauze over his eyes, felt the tape holding it there, and after some thought decided to have a look. His left arm held the IV, so he began picking at the tape with the fingers of his right hand. He was aware of voices in another room and steps on a hard floor. People were busy down the hall. Closer, someone was moaning in a low, steady, painful voice. He slowly worked the tape from his skin and hair and cursed the person who'd stuck it there. He laid the bandage to one side. It hung over his left ear. His first image was peeling paint, a dull shade of faded yellow on the wall just above him. The lights were off. Rays of sun drifted in from a window. The paint on the ceiling was cracked too, large black gaps shrouded with cobwebs and dust. A rickety fan dropped from the center and wobbled as it spun. 2 feet caught his attention. 2 old, gnarled, scarred feet, layered with wounds and calluses from toes to soles, sticking in the air. And when he lifted his head slightly, he saw that they belonged to a shriveled little man whose bed almost touched his. He appeared dead. The moaning came from the wall near the window. This poor guy was just as small and just as shriveled. He sat in the middle of his bed, arms and legs folded and tucked into a ball, and suffered his affliction in a trance. The smell was of old urine, human waste, and heavy antiseptic all mixed into one thick odor. Nurses laughed down the hall. The paint was peeling on every wall. There were 5 beds besides Nate's, all of the rollaway variety, parked here and there with little effort at order. His 3rd roommate was by the door. He was naked, except for a wet diaper, and his body was covered with open red sores. He too appeared dead, and Nate certainly hoped he was, for his own good. There were no buttons to push, no emergency cord or intercom, no way to summon help except for yelling. And this might wake the dead. These creatures might arise and want to visit with him. He wanted to run, to swing his feet off the bed, onto the floor, rip the IV from his arm, and sprint for freedom. He would take his chances on the street. Surely there couldn't be as much disease out there. Any place was better than this leper's ward. But his feet were like bricks. Nate tried mightily to lift them, one at a time, but they barely moved. Nate sunk his head to his pillow, closed his eyes, and thought about crying. "I am in a hospital in a third-world country," he said over and over. "I left Walnut Hill, $1,000 a day, push-button everything, carpet, showers, therapists at my beck and call." The man with the sores grunted, and Nate sank even lower. Then he carefully took the gauze and placed it over his eyes, and he taped it, just like before, only tighter this time. Chapter 35. Sneed arrived for the meeting with a contract of his own, one he had prepared without the aid of a lawyer. Hark read it, and had to admit that it was not a bad job of drafting. It was titled Contract for Expert Witness Services. Experts give opinions. Sneed would deal primarily with the facts, but Hark didn't care what the contract said. He signed it and handed over a certified check for $500,000. Sneed took it delicately, examined every word, then folded it and tucked it away in his coat pocket. "Now where do we start?" he said with a smile. There was so much to cover. The other Phelan lawyers wanted to be present. Hark had time only for a primer. "In general terms," he said, "what was the old man's frame of mind the morning he died?" Sneed squirmed and twisted and frowned, as if in deep thought. He really wanted to say the right things. He felt as though he had 4.5 million riding on him now.
He was out of his mind, he said, the words hanging in the air while he waited for approval.
Hark nodded. So far, so good. Was this unusual?
No. In his last days, he was hardly rational.
How much time did you spend with him?
Off and on, 24 hours a day.
Where did you sleep?
My room was down the hall, but he had a buzzer for me. I was on call around the clock. He would sometimes get up in the middle of the night and want juice or a pill. He simply pushed a button, the buzzer rang me, and I fetched whatever he wanted.
Who else lived with him?
No one.
Who else did he spend time with?
Perhaps young Nicolette, the secretary, he fancied her.
Did he have sex with her?
Would it help her case?
Yes.
Then they were screwing like rabbits.
Hark couldn't help but smile. The allegation that Troy was chasing his last secretary would surprise no one. It hadn't taken long for them to find the same sheet to sing from.
Look, Mr. Sneed, this is what we want. We need the quirks, the little oddities, the glaring lapses, the strange things he said and did when taken as a whole will convince anyone that he was not of sound mind. You have time. Sit down and begin writing. Put the pieces together. Have a chat with Nicolette. Make sure they were having sex. Listen to what she says.
She'll say anything we need.
Good. Then rehearse, and make sure there are no gaps that other lawyers can find. Your stories must hold together.
There's no one to contradict them.
No one? No limo driver, or maid, or ex-lover, or maybe another secretary?
He had all those, sure. But no one lived on the 14th floor but Mr. Phelan and myself. He was a very lonely man, and quite crazy.
Then how did he perform so well for the three psychiatrists?
Sneed thought about this for a moment. Fiction failed him.
What would you guess?
He asked.
I would guess that Mr. Phelan knew the examination would be difficult, because he knew he was slipping,
and so he asked you to prepare lists of anticipated questions, and that you and Mr. Phelan spent that morning reviewing such simple matters as the day's date, he couldn't keep it straight, and the names of children, names he'd virtually forgotten, where they went to college, who they were married to, etc. Then you covered questions about his health. I would guess that after you had drilled him on these basics, you spent at least 2 hours prompting him on his holdings, the structure of the Phelan Group, the companies he owned, the acquisitions he'd made, the closing prices of certain stocks. He relied on you more and more for financial news, and so this came easy for you. It was tedious for the old man, but you were determined to keep him sharp just before you wheeled him in for the exam.
Does this sound familiar?
Sneed liked it immensely. He was awed by the lawyer's gift of creating lies on the spot.
Yes, yes, that's it. That's how Mr. Phelan snowed the psychiatrists.
Then work on it, Mr. Sneed. The more you work on your stories, the better witness you'll be. The lawyers on the other side will come after you. They will attack your testimony and call you a liar. So you must be ready. Write everything down so you'll always have a record of your stories.
I like that idea.
Dates, times, places, incidents, oddities. Everything, Mr. Sneed. Same for Nicolette. Make her write it down.
She doesn't write well.
Help her. It's up to you, Mr. Sneed. You want the rest of the money, then earn it.
How much time do I have?
We, the other lawyers, and myself would like to video you in a few days. We'll hear your stories, pepper you with questions, then watch your performance. I'm sure we'll want to change some things. We'll coach you along, maybe do more videos. When things are perfect, then you'll be ready for your deposition.
Sneed left in a hurry. He wanted to put the money in the bank and buy a new car. Nicolette needed one, too. A night orderly on his rounds noticed the empty bag. The hand-printed instructions on the back of it said that the fluid should not be interrupted. He took it to the pharmacy, where a part-time student nurse remixed the chemicals and gave the bag back to the orderly. There were rumors around the hospital about the rich American patient. In his sleep, Nate was refortified with drugs he didn't need. When Chevy found him before breakfast, he was half awake, eyes still covered because he preferred the darkness.
"Welly's here," Chevy whispered.
The nurse on duty helped Chevy roll the bed from the room, down the hall, and into a small courtyard where there was sunshine. The nurse turned a crank, and half the bed inclined. She removed the gauze and tape, and Nate never flinched. He slowly opened his eyes and tried to focus. Chevy, just inches away, said,
"The swelling is down." "Hello, Nate,"
Welly said. He was hovering on the other side. The nurse left them.
"Hello, Welly,"
Nate said, his words deep, slow, thick. He was groggy but happy. How well he knew the feeling of being stoned. Chevy patted his forehead and announced, "The fever is gone, too." The Brazilians smiled at each other, relieved that they had not killed the American during their excursion into the Pantanal.
"What happened to you?"
Nate asked Welly, trying to clip his words and not sound like a drunk. Chevy passed along the question in Portuguese. Welly was instantly animated and began his long narrative about the storm and the sinking of the Santa Laura. Chevy stopped him every 30 seconds for the translation. Nate listened while trying to keep his eyes open, but he floated in and out of the scene. Valdir found them there. He greeted Nate warmly, delighted that their guest was sitting up in bed and looking better. He whipped out a cell phone, and as he punched numbers, he said,
"You must talk to Mr. Stafford. He's quite anxious."
"I'm not sure I..."
Nate's words trailed off as he drifted.
"Here, sit up. He's Mr. Stafford,"
Valdir said, handing him the phone and puffing up his pillow. Nate took the phone and said,
"Hello?"
"Nate," came the reply. "Is that you?"
"Josh."
"Nate, tell me you're not going to die. Please tell me."
"I'm not sure," Nate said.
Valdir gently pushed the phone closer to Nate's head and helped him hold it in place.
"Speak louder,"
he whispered. Chevy and Welly stepped back.
"Nate, did you find Rachel Lane?"
Josh yelled into the phone. Nate rallied for a second. He frowned hard, trying to concentrate.
"No," he said.
"What?"